Tired of the price of everything going up these days? Groceries, rent, you name it. It's all going up. But not at Metro. They've got your back. Metro has lowered their prices and are giving you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. One line? Now 20% lower. Family plans? Also lowered. Oh, and you also get a free 5G phone. All with no ID required and no activation fees. Stop by your neighborhood Metro store, visit metrobytmobile.com, or call to find out about their amazing offers. Bring your number, not available if currently at T-Mobile or with Metro in the past 180 days. Guarantee covers monthly price of on-network talk, text, and 5G data for customers activating on an eligible plan. Exclusions apply. Details at metrobytmobile.com.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Virginia. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Welcome to It Takes Energy, presented by Energy Transfer, where we talk all things oil and natural gas. Oil and gas drive our economy, ensure our country's security, and open pathways to brighter futures. When it comes to meeting the world's energy needs, more is better. What we mean is our world needs a wide range of energy sources to meet our increasing needs. Just wind or solar won't get us there, as the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. With our growing population and the increasing use of energy-demanding technologies like AI, reliability is key. And the reliability of natural gas is unmatched by wind and solar. That doesn't mean we all can't work together, but natural gas is vital to ensuring we meet our energy needs. Look around, and you'll see the essential role oil and gas plays in our lives. Our world needs oil and gas, and people rely on us to deliver it. To learn more, visit energytransfer.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you only by The Nation magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. I am joined this week by not just basketball, but movie savant, Arya Shirazi. And let me tell you why I brought Arya back. We did a show at the end of 2024 about baseball movies, and it got a wide listenership. And I received feedback that said, why don't you talk about what you think of the top non-baseball movies. Now, the tough thing about that is that if you take out boxing, for example, which has so many great movies, once you get past boxing and baseball, it's really a cut below in terms of all-time sports movies, but they all still deserve discussion, and maybe part of that discussion is why they don't work in the first place. So we're going to talk about the most highly regarded, that's a good way to put it, non-baseball, non-boxing sports movies. Why non-boxing? Because it's too easy. Too many boxing movies. But we're going to talk about them in a way that's critical. And I can't think of anybody I'd want to talk about this more with than the guy you wanted to hear more from about movies, Arya Shirazi. Hello, Arya. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, Dave. Thank you for the high praise. And I'm glad that our previous movie discussion was received well enough for there to be even a small demand for a second one.
Well, I wonder if people are going to like this one less because we're going to be more going like we were exalting in the last episode in great films like Eight Men Out and Bull Durham. Now this is a little bit more complicated space because these movies, some of them do great things, some of them less so, some of them hold up, some of them don't, but they're the most well-known, highly regarded. That's the category. So let's start with a film that I know you and I watched more than once back in the day, White Men Can't Jump. Had you seen it recently? Thoughts about it? Where does that rank for you as a sports film?
I saw, actually, I believe that you and I saw White Men Can't Jump when it came out. And I remember being pretty critical about the actual basketball scenes. We've played an incredible amount of outdoor basketball. I've probably played many more hours of outdoor ball than I have indoor ball. And outdoor basketball, city basketball, was something very kind of personal to me. And as I said, I remember kind of scoffing at a lot of the basketball action in White Men Can't Jump. The skills of the star actors, particularly Wesley Snipes, and just like the general kind of slow motion dramatics in which the hoops was presented. I recall, as I said, kind of not being too complimentary about the actual ba basketball action. I have seen the film at least once in my adulthood. And not only does it still stand up as a pretty strong comedy, but I really liked it. And, I'm a little over myself as far as the authenticity of on-court action. But in general, White Men Can't Jump is a movie I like and definitely a sports, basketball movie that I like.
Yeah, I'll come back on this. I'm not over myself because when I saw it recently, I couldn't get over what a just horrible basketball player Wesley Snipes is. And it was surprising because wouldn't you have to say that Wesley Snipes might be our finest actor athlete of the last 30 years? Not athlete actor, but actor who's also an amazing athlete. He's done baseball, he's done football. He's done tons of kung fu, all very credibly, but just the worst basketball player I've ever seen. Dribbling the ball up to his shoulder. I mean, no, I've never seen anybody play like that. People going like, oof, missing the ball when you're like, are you kidding me? Ridiculous. And you know who shamed himself in this film? Former UCLA great Nigel Miguel, who played one of the players in the 2-on-2. He allowed himself to get punked by Wesley Snipes. You're better than that, Nigel Miguel. But a great cameo by Marcus Johnson as well, like a very underrated basketball player from the 80s. He was the guy who did the hold up and, the mask. And then, Wesley Snipes somehow beats Marcus frickin' Johnson to the hoop. I don't know. That I couldn't be over that. Woody's fantastic. Love Rosie Perez. Holds up great. I even do like some of the basketball that doesn't involve Wesley. But at the end of the day, I'm not quite sure it lands the plane. I'm really not. Like it tries for something deep at the end that I feel like it didn't necessarily earn.
Yeah, it is not a particularly deep film, and I think it's strongest when it settles into its comfort zone as a 90s light comedy. As far as Wesley goes, he's proof that you might look great in a tank top or a baseball uni, but looks can be deceiving, and that's why there's editing and camera tricks.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's absolutely right. Very different from, as I think we're going to discuss in a little bit, a certain contemporary of Wesley Snipes, who may not be the athlete he is, but twice the basketball player. And his name rhymes with Schmenzel. What about like the whole Ron Shelton connection? Is that worth talking about? He writes and directs Bull Durham. He's a former minor league baseball player. He writes and directs White Men Can't Jump. Do you see a footprint one to the other? I mean, Ron Shelton really hasn't done that many films, and I don't know. There's good in White Men Can't Jump. I would watch it with my kid, for example, and we'd have a good time. But I gotta say, like, I think Ron Shelton, what he's able to do in Bull Durham, he's not quite able to do with this.
Oh, I mean, he definitely peaked with Bull Durham. And I think so far, it looks like Ron had one great film in him. But the footprint is that he follows up Bull Durham a few years later with another kind of rollicking sports film that, even if it doesn't reach the creative heights of that one, I think it's still a pretty good follow-up. And it's nice that he kind of stayed within the sports zone.
Yeah.
So the guy makes decent sports films.
Yeah. So we'll call White Men Can't Jump, you know, maybe at a Maurice Cheeks level film.
Mo Cheeks might be a Hall of Famer.
He is a Hall of Famer, but this is the basketball.
Do you consider White Men Can't Jump a Hall of Fame film?
Bro, this is the Basketball Hall of Fame. They just inducted Michael Cooper.
Anything goes.
Anything goes. Coop, you're in, buddy. I know you didn't start for those Lakers teams, but who cares?
At this point, I'm willing to endorse Rosie O'Donnell. Rosie Perez. Rosie Perez's induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Rosie O'Donnell is purely Cooperstown material.
She actually might be Rosie in the Boxing Hall of Fame, believe it or not. That might have to be another pod. All right, next film that everybody has in the top, Slapshot. Paul Newman, late 70s, minor league hockey, very violent. People also find it hilarious. Cult film to the nth degree. Your thoughts, Slapshot.
Yeah, I agree that Slapshot is very highly regarded. And I remember seeing it as a young kid on late night TV and chuckling at it. When I saw it as an older person, I wasn't really chuckling anymore. I'm not really a hockey fan. I have not been a hockey fan. And I'm not a fan of hockey culture. And Slapshot is hockey culture, which, as I said, I don't really dig. And the film does not transcend across those lines. The last time I saw it, I found it pretty obnoxious. Mm-hmm. Didn't really like any of the characters. I'm a big Paul Newman fan. I think he's had one of the greatest careers of any American actor. Even he, in my opinion, can't really salvage this one. And those three idiot triplets with the glasses, who are kind of really supposed to provide the primary comic material, I hate those guys.
Mm-hmm. Bro, man, I hate this movie. Thank you for saying so. There have been times in my life, I'm ashamed to say, that I pretended to like Slapshot. Because, you know, you're in a big group of guys and everybody's watching it and they're calling each other hosers. And the only thing I could think is, I need new friends.
That's the thought that was going through my mind when you told me that story. So I want you surrounded by better company.
Those early months of college, not everybody gets as lucky as you, sir. Meeting good folks right off the bat. Some of us have to watch Slapshot with a bunch of hosers.
I'm sorry.
So, yeah, man. Dark days. But the problem with it, the most damning thing you could say about it, is that Paul Newman can't save it. Because I'm like in love with Paul Newman's career. Like, I'm like, I feel like I'm attracted to it because it's so freaking cool. because he gets to do the young stuff, the Cool Hand Luke stuff, the Verdict stuff, the Color of Money. I mean, it's just a, nobody's fool. I mean, it's just a really fun career to chart through of just amazing movies and amazing performances. And this, I don't like that people put this among some of the films I just said. Hey, The Hustler and Slapshot. It's like, are you kidding me? I'm going to slap your face for putting The Hustler and Slapshot in the same sentence. And I also think the movie, I mean, I'm sorry, but like, it's just like, it's like one of the most misogynistic movies I've ever seen. I mean, this movie hates women to such a degree that you just, that part for me is also why I've never shown it to my kid, for example, who, by the way, also doesn't like hockey. So I don't know why I'd show it to him in the first place. And that's, I got to say one last thing, is that if you don't know hockey, I can't imagine why you'd want to see this violent, grubby little film.
And actually, I'm certain that many, many people who didn't know hockey saw this film and then got into hockey.
Yeah, box office smash.
Because it's a very, very popular film that has endured in the probably almost 50 years since it came out. And it's a notable addition in Paul's filmography, mm-hmm. in his later career. It just happens to be one that that you and I don't like. Mm-hmm. And I like you more for not liking that film.
Thank you. And I would like you more if you know who directed it.
George Roy.
Oh, man. The only reason I'm giving you George Roy Hill, of course, is referencing the director of The Sting, most famously. The reason I'm like giving you props on that is because I had to look it up. And anytime you know something I don't, it's like, I just got to tip the hat. That's not just you. That's everybody. No. If somebody knows shit you don't know, you tip your hat.
Well, thank you. I think that's probably one of the few things that I know that you do not know. But George Roy Hill, had worked with Paul Newman on The Sting, but even earlier had directed Paul and Robert Redford in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which is at the top of my list of all-time faves. The very short list. So, so those two had done really, really good work together, and we're in the minority in feeling that that didn't continue with Slapshot.
Yeah, terrible. All right, next one. You and I, over the years, have been big Spike Lee fans. I've also always respected, first of all, his New York Knicks fandom. I really do, and because it comes from the heart. And like, you go to 40 Acres and a Mule Studios in Brooklyn, the flag out front is a New York Knicks championship banner. I mean, from like 69, 70. So, that's pretty, pretty damn cool. But he also did his basketball film, his magnum opus, He Got Game, Denzel Washington, Ray Allen. They almost cast Travis Best in the Ray Allen role. How life would be different. And he actually does have a bit in the film, Travis Best. People don't even know who Travis Best is. I'm going to shut up. Ari, He Got Game, your thoughts?
I saw He Got Game when it came out, late 90s, and it just is not very memorable to me. It just didn't stick. And I like Spike, and it's Spike's basketball film, so I was probably pretty enthusiastic to see it. And I'm certainly not saying that I dislike it, but it just did not stick. I have not seen it since. I have heard it in the decades since, been spoken not only highly regarded as far as sports films, but also as far as an entry in Spike's catalog, an important entry in Spike's lengthy catalog. And apparently it just didn't do it for me. I'd be interested to see how I'd feel about it today, after so many years, after really remembering so little, it's Ray Allen as Jesus Shuttlesworth, I know that. And Ray just a couple of years into his NBA career, so really kind of UConn Ray in a way, which I remember thinking was cool and a good decision for Spike to do that rather than casting an actor, rather than casting somebody like Wesley Snipes. I think, Shelton proved that that didn't really work. And I apologize for trashing Wesley so much on this episode because I really love Wesley Snipes.
He's
But
amazing.
I'm interested to know your thoughts on He Got Game because I have relatively few.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot. I feel like maybe of any film I've ever seen in my entire life, it's the most frustrating because all the elements are there, from Spike's hoops knowledge to Ray Allen's acting ability, which is good enough, but factored in with his ball playing, which, when Spike filming Ray Allen in an intimate setting, I mean, Ray Allen's one of the most beautiful shooters to ever live. And so you think about Spike's filmmaking skills in a gym, just Ray Allen shooting by himself as Jesus Shuttlesworth. It's beautiful. And Denzel, oh my God, I'm an all-time Denzel-it. So him in and of himself is so good in the film as Jake Shuttlesworth. But oh my God, it is 45 minutes too long. And that's a real problem. Like, this film should be tight. It is not. There are characters who don't need to be there, scenes that don't need to be there, obnoxious, weird stuff that doesn't need to be there. Like, all right, I like the idea of Jesus Shuttlesworth being set up to, have sex when he visits the campus, because I know that happens. But a threesome with two porn stars in their mid-20s, I mean, it's just stupid. It's like, what kind of film? And then Jesus, like, smiles at the camera, like, ho. And it's just like, what are you doing, Spike? It should be a tight film, man. John Turturro as the sleazy Calipari-esque coach is amazing. Like, it's all there. And he blows it. I mean, really, like, some 1 yard line fumble stuff to me. It makes me sad, too. I love Spike. I'll tell you this, though. The one thing, though, even if one person doesn't know this story, the famous one-on-one scene between Ray Allen and Denzel Washington. You know this story, right? Yeah, because I've told it before. So on this very show. So I'm going to keep it quick and just say I'm not going to do it all dramatic. The script had Ray Allen winning 11 to nothing. That's what, and Spike and Denzel decided in secret to play seriously. And it's all done in one shot. Like, there are no edits. And so Ray Allen does the check to Denzel. It's all one take. Denzel nails the first shot. And you see, like, a little bit of the confusion from Ray Allen. And then Ray Allen gives him the ball back because Denzel's still in character. He hits another. And now Ray Allen starts to get pissed off. And there's some tough fouls and all this. It's just a, such a terrific scene, and they blow it. So that's my thoughts on He Got Game. It was there for the taking.
I think, and I'll try to keep this brief, but in agreeing with you that baseball and boxing films are kind of the pinnacle of sports on film, and why that is kind of a lazy answer, at least the first one that came into my head was the nature of boxing. I mean, boxing is kind of the most, I think, narrative and thusly kind of cinematic sport. That one-on-one. Who will triumph? Who will fail? Kind of tailor-made for drama. And similarly with baseball, there's nothing really in sports like the pitcher-batter relationship. You can say, a goalie and against somebody taking a penalty shot. But that but it's really not the same.
No.
The batter versus the pitcher.
Yeah.
You can do a clo you can do a close up on the batter, a close up on the pitcher, or place your camera behind the pitcher, and there is your drama right there. Sports with a larger field or a larger court, it's harder for the camera, I think, to accurately and adequately reproduce the beauty of those live sports. Because even as a spectator, if you're watching basketball or watching football, yes, your eye is primarily on the ball, but your peripheral always has a sense of the larger playing field and where the action is in contrast to the larger playing field and where that ball wants to go. It's harder for the frame to pick up the scope of that when it is trying to concentrate on dramatic action. So again, that's somewhat of a simplistic
No.
explanation, but in thinking about these films and agreeing with you that very few films reach the dramatic satisfaction or emotion that the best baseball and boxing films do, that's kind of the best explanation I can grasp as to why that might be the case.
Well, let me throw another basketball film at you, and I guess we can talk about not just why. We don't think the film is as good as the critics say, but also maybe how what we think of the basketball scenes and if they're filmed better than some of what we're talking about. But let me just say that what I said about He Got Game, I have to say, is broadly the consensus view of He Got Game. Like, a lot of genius, 45 minutes too long, Spike, you're your own worst enemy. Like, that's the consensus view of that film. What I'm about to say is not the consensus view, because this film is always top one, two, or three in the sports movie list, and I'm talking about Hoosiers. Not a fan. Throw it to, and but I do think they actually do the basketball quite well. But who cares? I can't stand this film. Throw it to you, Ari. Am I alone on this? Am I alone on I Hate Hoosiers Island?
It's funny, Dave. I guess I never really knew your feelings about Hoosiers. And I was planning on using this platform or possibly abusing this platform to debunk the legend of Hoosiers that has really endured since it came out in the mid-80s. And before I really start trashing it, because I'm similarly not a fan, I was definitely kind of drinking the Hoosiers Kool-Aid when it first came out. And for many years afterward, I think if you had asked me 10 years ago what my favorite sports films were, Hoosiers would have appeared near the top of the list. And now that I have revisited it fairly recently, I can't possibly imagine why it was, because it is a movie that has numerous narrative holes. Kind of bafflingly, it appears as though a chunk of the film was left on the cutting room floor, making certain plot developments and characters confusing or outright incomprehensible at times. There's a sloppiness to that film, but that isn't my primary issue with it. The reason that I used to think I liked Hoosiers was I bought into it as the kind of the epitome of team basketball. Basketball is the beautiful sport when five players are working together, and Hoosiers captures that. And the character of Norman Dale, as their uncompromising, hard-driving coach, yeah, I mean, it's his way or the highway, and he's committed. And once the players buy in, they see the success. Turns out, I can't stand Norman Dale. His view on basketball could not be more different than mine. The way he relates to his young players, who he has authority over, is exactly the opposite of how I like to relate to players when I coach them. And his methods, his philosophy, really sucks the joy out of the game, out of the most beautiful game, in my opinion. This is not a coach that I would want to play for. This is not a coach that I would want to spend any time around, a character that I'd want to spend any time around. And it wounds me to say that, because Norman Dale is portrayed by Gene Hackman. If there's an actor that whose career I love more than Paul Newman, it's Gene Hackman, but one of my absolute favorites since I saw Superman. And this is kind of one of Gene's signature roles. But as I said, it turns out I am really not a Hoosiers fan. And my reckoning for that was years ago, when I showed it to my son, who had started to play organized basketball and loved the game, and I put on Hoosiers, and pretty early on felt that it was a mistake and was feeling as though how basketball was presented in this film is not how I want to present it and not how I hope that young players would receive it.
Okay, I agree with everything you said. Fun fact, Gene Hackman was the first person cast to play Mike Brady on the Brady Bunch. He was the original Brady dad. How odd.
That's a very fun fact.
Yeah, another fun fact. Also the first choice for Hannibal Lecter was Gene Hackman, which I could kind of see. You know, that
I could see it, but I'm glad it was Hopkins.
Yeah, I'm glad it was Hopkins too. I mean, there's no one else. That would like be Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid starring, you know, Peter Fonda and Mickey Rooney. The same thing. What a duo. Yeah, I also hate Hoosiers. It's also one of the things I've just learned about more in recent years is the incredibly inverted racist narrative of the film, where the real heroes of Indiana basketball at that time were people like Oscar Robertson, playing in schools that were newly segregated or schools that were under tremendous social pressure and playing a different kind of basketball with some very forward-thinking coaches. These players were amazing, and they were the future. But this film is backward-looking. It looks back at the way things used to be. And I think the character of Norman Dale that you described is a part of that. You know, this is the sort of film that reveres Bob Knight. And as you and I both know, El General, Bobby Knight, is nobody anybody should be emulating. And another interesting, you know, just like your turn on Hoosiers, you know that I was a huge Bobby Knight fan back in the day. But like you grow up and you learn who these people are and you really start to ask the question, would I want my kid playing for this coach? And then you get a different value system. And I, of course, would argue a fucking better value system than the one Norman Dale has. And the last thing I'll say, I don't usually care too much about award shows, but that was the year of Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet. And everybody thought Hopper was going to get a nomination for Blue Velvet, Best Supporting Actor. He did not, but he got one for Hoosiers, where he just plays like the drunken dickwad dad. And I just think that that's just yet another Shonda associated with this film, is that it allowed the Academy an out for honoring Blue Velvet the way it deserves to be honored.
Definitely another mark against it. Hoosiers is a feel-good story, an inspirational film. So it certainly does not want to delve into deeper social issues. racial issues and being on the wrong side of racial opinions. There is a slight nod to that towards the end of the film when tiny plucky Hickory makes it to the state finals in big city Indianapolis. And you know it's the big city, you know they're out of their small town because the opposing team has a couple of black players. And whoa, so Hickory might be a little over their head, but fortunately, Normandale,
The
they
five-man weave prevailed.
exactly they run the picket fence a few times, and the white heroes from Hickory are able to prevail.
By the good
So
grace of Jimmy Chitwood, which is a great name. All right, I'll give him credit for that one. But yeah, and also, a wasted Barbara Hershey. Who we're supposed to think finds Normandale just sexually magnetic.
yeah, I'm sure that Gene was happy to read about those developments in the script. Yeah, and this is the movie where Barbara Hershey doesn't shoot anyone, although if she had decided to pump a couple into Hopper, I wouldn't have argued.
Reference to, of course, her role in The Natural. Shooting young Robert Redford. I could also throw down with a Boxcar Bertha reference for Barbara Hershey, another sports film. And of course, the sport of fending off a Randy Michael Caine. Okay, I'll let that one go. Aria, before we finish this up, there are a couple more boxes I want to check. The first is, the most popular sport in the United States by a country mile is, of course, football. In terms of viewership, etc. But we haven't mentioned one football movie, and yet football movies are traditionally actually extremely popular. There's some really, historically. I mean, you have movies like Invincible, for example, Draft Day, which I think was that also Shelton? It might have been Shelton. I really do think so. The Program, I mean, and then a couple that, that have really stood the test of time, even though I don't really like them. One of them being Rudy, about the Notre Dame kid. I mean, but what's your take generally? Has there ever been a football movie that's tickled your fancy? And why do you think we haven't even had football as part of our conversation yet? It's not like, especially me, it's not like we're not conversant with the sport.
Yeah, no, there have been over the decades, many, many football films and big football films. And I might think that there have been more solid football films that kind of capture the culture and the hysteria of football, whether it's on the high school level with Friday Night Lights film and the series,
Fantastic.
or co the frenzy of college football, big time college football, and many films about the world of pro football. As I had said, much with basketball, I think football doesn't lend itself as cinematically as a sport because of the enormity of the field. And unlike a pitcher-batter relationship, capturing football action and making it compelling, I think, has some challenges. That said, there have been many football films that I've really enjoyed. One that definitely comes to mind is Remember the Titans, which is from the late 90s, somewhat of a period piece about school integration in Virginia in the 1970s. Even for the South, Virginia was very late to that boat. Apparently, stubbornly clung on to school segregation, but about after school integration, two schools are merged and their football programs are subsequently merged. And it's about the players and the coaches. Denzel Washington is at the head of the cast as one of the two head coaches who, when the two programs are consolidated, is elevated to head coach while his white counterpart is his assistant. And I really think that it hits on all of the important levels as a drama, as a historical drama dealing with a important and at the time under discussed sensitive part of American history, and as a football film, as a sports film. And that's also where it stands out, because not only does it really work as a period drama, but I think the football scenes really work as well.
Yeah, you know, a film I love is The Longest Yard with Burt Reynolds, but that's not what I want to say something very quickly about, and then we'll move on from the football stuff. But a film we haven't mentioned yet, although you did mention it the other day off air, North Dallas 40, I think has to deserve mention. Like, even if it's not as intensely well done from a film perspective in terms of what it shows on the field, the kind of reality stuff of what it was saying and exposing about the NFL, and particularly the Dallas Cowboys that the organization was based on, America's team. I mean, this was some radical filmmaking. First of all, a radical book by Peter Gent, who I got to interview and meet, former Dallas Cowboy wide receiver before he passed away. Gent wrote a great book. It's one of my faves. North Dallas 40, and it's and I think the film with Nick Nolte accomplishes a few things that I think a film today would even be scared to do. I mean, there was the film Concussion about the NFL, and that just got destroyed at the box office, and the NFL like leaked things about it and all sorts of stuff. I mean, people don't even want to go there when it comes to pro football, even if they'll do like exposés of high school or college and the like.
Yeah, I like North Dallas 40, and it's been a long, long time. And even just hearing you talk briefly about it now reminds me that I really should see it again, because it's been very, very many years. But what I remember of it, I really like. And I agree with you. I think in a way that film is kind of major league 10 years before that, but less goofy than that, story-wise, but kind of that, you know, this is the look into a professional locker room at the highest level of this sport. Unlike the Sad Sack Cleveland Indians, they're kind of the standard bearer franchise. Dallas Cowboys, which, as you said, kind of up the stakes, you know, considerably, as kind of an expose, but really
there's a Tom Landry-esque coach and a guy, Tex Schramm, ex-general manager that was, for its time, beyond transparent for the people watching.
Yeah, and to my knowledge, it is the first film, or certainly one of the first, to glorify a male sports team while also making it clear that behaviorally these are not role models.
Yeah, no, that's right. They showed the attraction of it. Ooh, I gotta say one more. It's hard to even call this a sports movie about football, but football's a big part of it. Bro, I'm a big fan of The Last Boy Scout. Bruce Willis, Damon Wayans. Come on, Damon Wayans is the quarterback. With the drug addiction. I mean, the Billy Blanks, a terrific B-movie actor in the opening scene, shooting people as he runs down the field. I mean, I don't know. Just a tip of the hat to Shane Black, the writer-director of The Last Boy Scout, with a terrific performance by Taylor Negron.
It's similarly been a very long time since I've seen Boy Scout. Almost none of it is fresh in my mind, except that very jarring first scene where homicide and suicide is committed on the football field. And I remember it as being a bizarre film.
Yeah, I'll give it that.
With football as its backdrop.
Yes.
It's not really a sports movie, but it has you know, football players and football culture kind of, you know, hovering over the atmosphere.
Yeah, if one likes Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans, it'll be a good time. If either of those people make you itch, just stay away. So moving on from the football world, I think we do want to give mention to one other film that's not baseball, but it is our preferred sport at basketball, and it's the only film that's ever really captured the poetry and pathos and beauty of the game and the people who make the game what it is in all its warts and all. And of course, the movie I'm talking about is Hoop Dreams. Shiraz, I say the words Hoop Dreams. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it for me, it took a documentary to make a beautiful basketball movie. As I have said on this forum in the past, basketball to me is the beautiful sport. It is my favorite sport to play. It's my favorite sport to watch. It's my favorite sport to think about. And as we had talked about earlier, it has seemed difficult to narratively capture the magic of basketball. Hoop Dreams, made about 30 years ago now, which is crazy, is a wonderful film about two Chicago teenagers who are pegged for basketball stardom and are kind of treated that way and handled that way at a young age. Their paths diverge throughout the course of the film. But yeah, I mean, I'd say that that is the most powerful basketball movie that I've ever seen. And like almost all the others that we've talked about here, I'm definitely due for a rewatch, but the last time I saw it, it absolutely held up. There was nothing dated about it. A great film.
You know what? I might put on the old vision board. We do like a screening of it for the younger generation in our respective lives. Get them all together and watch it. And be like, this is really special. But hey, this is not a forum to plan such matters. Moving on to a last issue. As we said early on in the pod about baseball, and then we said, yeah, and we're not going to talk about boxing either. And because Ari and I both thought that boxing is almost too obvious. There's so many great boxing films because it is so schematic, the same way Ari earlier in the show talked about the pitcher-hitter dynamic, very similar in boxing, this kind of one-on-one exercise in machismo, or in the case of the forthcoming Christy Martin film starring Sydney Sweeney, Facisma. This is what we're faced with right now. Best boxing film, or a boxing film you think people should see. Shiraz, what's your boxing film?
No, it made sense that the ground rules of this talk wouldn't include boxing films because, as you said, that's really kind of a category unto itself. Boxing has an aura of tragedy to it by nature of it, I think, and which lends itself to drama. And drama in literature, and certainly drama in film. There are, if I'm hard pressed to come up with a really, really great basketball feature film, there are countless great boxing films, all with their different perspective and kind of different flavor. Raging Bull is one of my all-time favorite movies in general. It's been a film that's just been very important personally throughout my life. But the film that I want to call out here is Fat City, directed by John Huston, about 10 years before he tackled Little Orphan Annie. Not literally.
Eileen Quinn, look out.
Yeah, and she's still on top of the industry. But Fat City, there's nothing glamorous about this movie. And there's nothing glamorous about the characters. It is from the early 70s, and it is about club fighters and the survival and the hard existence of club fighters. The kind of two protagonists are an aging fighter who never advanced beyond the local club scene, just trying to continue to hang on for a few more bouts and a few more paychecks. And then the younger boxer just starting out, who becomes mentored by the older fighter. And it's kind of inevitable that he's going to be following the same fate, or wind up, with a similar conclusion. So Fat City is just a movie that it's got a very unique feel to it, among boxing movies, among movies about low-key films, about down and out life on the margins, but very, very memorable, and definitely one of the first films that always comes to mind when I think of boxing movies that have really had an impact.
You know, the film I'm gonna say is Rocky Five, the most derided of the Rocky films. That's the one with Tommy, the Duke Morrison, playing Tommy Gunn. Tremendous performances across the board. Talia Shire, Stallone at his absolute best. So much pathos in the performance. His own son Sage. Taking center stage with Sage. I mean, the chemistry of father and son. Stallone gets poor after getting head injuries and moves back to the old neighborhood for some reason. That's not a good choice. And it's everything. I think it's so underrated. It's everything you want in a Rocky movie. And one of the reasons, Shiraz, why I hold it so close to my heart is, of course, because I watched it as part of a radio contest where you had to sit in the movie theater and watch all five Rockies in a row the day that Rocky Five came out. And so my memory of it is just being punch drunk after having watched all of these Rockies. So there it is.
I do remember that occurring. And there is something very cosmically correct about a young Dave Zirin being gifted a five film Rocky marathon because of winning a radio contest. All of that is just so right, and remains so all these years later. Yes, I will verify that at the time you praised Rocky Five, and I didn't believe you at the time. I didn't believe there was any way it could be good. And after all these years, I've never seen it. And at my core, there's no way I can believe that it's good. But you have been such a consistent supporter ever from day one that's something that neither I or anybody else can ever take away from you.
Thank you. I wrote an article for Grantland about why Rocky V was the greatest Rocky movie. Like, I've put my name to the published word about Rocky V. I'll tell you what, if you watch Rocky V, I will watch a film that I have not seen, Fat City. Never seen it. But
Right.
I know it's got Jeff Bridges. So you see Rocky V, I'll see Fat City. Then we'll be square.
I will accept those terms.
Excellent. Well, Shiraz, I think we got it all covered. any last words for the home team?
Really looking forward to finally seeing the fifth installment of the Balboa saga.
And I as well. Very excited for a little Stacy Keach, Jeff Bridges action. Wait, that sounded like a very different kind of film.
You never know.
You never know these days.
It was the 70s.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played. Okay. Well, everybody, yo, be well. Thanks for listening. Nation Magazine, respect. I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace.